Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. The Aspen Institute continues to tackle the age-old entrance to Aspen traffic problem.
Governor Hickenlooper reflects on this year's legislative session.
Oil and gas companies must examine flow lines within 1,000 feet of occupied buildings after an explosion in Firestone killed two people.
And we talked to the new CEO of Holy Cross Energy.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Aspen citizens looking to block a new city building say they gained the support they needed for a referendum vote. Allison Bektesh reports.
A petition that would block the proposed development of a new Aspen City Hall received more than 700 signatures over the weekend. Aspen residents Stephen Goldberg and Marsha Goshorn authored the measure, which would reverse an ordinance allowing the city to reconfigure the Galena Plaza property. Those signatures now must be verified by City Clerk Linda Manning. She will also address whether the ordinance can even be repealed and the legality of the signature due date. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
Governor Hickenlooper says this year's legislative session was the most productive of his 7 years in office. But as Benta Berkland reports, he's contemplating a special legislative session to tackle transportation funding.
The governor says there are two main drivers for a possible special session. First, lawmakers failed to pass a bipartisan measure to send a transportation ballot question to voters this fall to get more money for roads. Second, the legislature didn't fund the Colorado Energy Office.
Well, in a special session, you have a little more time, and maybe bills can be assigned to the places where they can get a fair hearing, have the media, and therefore the entire state, see exactly who's saying what. Sometimes you get a more fair hearing by doing something like that.
Hickenlooper says he will only bring lawmakers back if he thinks it'll be worth the time and money and they'll get something done. He last called a special session 5 years ago. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Mayors, council members, and county commissioners from across Colorado will gather in Aspen over the next 2 days to discuss climate change initiatives. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has the details.
Aspen Mayor Steve Scadron attended the 2015 Paris Climate Talks as part of an international organization of mayors who commit to local action to reduce greenhouse gases. Now he wants to use that experience as a model to create a statewide network of communities that want to act on climate change. The first step is to get everyone in the same room. So 86 government officials from ski towns, Front Range communities, and small towns as far away as Ray, Colorado, will meet in Aspen this week.
It's going to be a fun event. It's not a room full of climate zealots telling you to sell your car, you don't eat tofu. It's a balanced exchange around sound principles of a clean economy.
The ultimate goal of the summit is to encourage attendees to sign on to a new organization called the Compact of Colorado Communities. Scadron describes this as a network of mayors and elected officials dedicated to fighting climate change in their communities. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
On April 17th, an explosion north of Denver killed two men. Gas leaked from a nearby flow line and into the house they were in. Governor Hickenlooper has since given oil and gas operators around the state 30 days to check thousands of wells and miles of pipeline. Wyatt spoke with producer Kristen Kay about what this means locally. He started by explaining what a flow line is.
A flow line is a pipe, and maybe it's made of metal, maybe plastic, and it brings the gas and the oil and probably some water out of the well. And so Governor Hickenlooper has ordered oil and gas companies to basically examine their flow lines that are within 1,000 feet of occupied buildings. So basically, before May 30th, oil and gas companies need to go to their well pads that are close to buildings and make sure everything is in order. In other words, that point A on any given flow line goes to point B. And then they have 30 more days to test what's called the integrity of the flow lines. So basically, checking for leaks and things like that.
So focusing in locally, how many flow lines are there in, say, Garfield County?
We don't know. And we don't know because the state doesn't keep track of this number. I talked to a man named Todd Hartman. He's the communications director at the Department of Natural Resources. He said flow lines aren't something that the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission tracks. The acronym for that is the COGCC. If oil and gas companies do know where their flow lines are, they don't have to share that information publicly. I reached out to Ursa Resources, which is a company that operates a little over 450 wells in Garfield and Rio Blanco counties, and they emailed a statement back to me that said, basically, we have maps of our newer flow lines, but we're not going to release them to the public. What we do know is that there are a little over 11,000 active wells in Garfield County, and each of those wells is going to have at least one flow line.
Why doesn't Garfield County know how many flow lines are within 1,000 feet of buildings?
Basically, Garfield County says it's not their job. I just spoke with officials there, and they said the county is not the regulatory agency over oil and gas. That's the state's job. They did, however, confirm that they're providing GIS maps to the oil and gas companies, which will help them identify where flow lines are, especially those that are within 1,000 feet of occupied structures.
The Aspen Institute continues its Community Forum for Transportation and Mobility with two events in the coming weeks. Tony Dutzik is a senior policy analyst with Frontier Group. Greg Rooks is a principal in the Rocky Mountain Institute's Transportation Department. Allison Bechtesh spoke with both experts about what they can bring to the decades-long Entrance to Aspen discussion.
The way Tony Dutzik sees it, there are actually quite a few aspects we are talking about when people refer to a community's transportation problem.
Traffic congestion.
That makes sense. It's visceral. We have all had that experience of sitting in traffic instead of getting where we need to go. But also,
safety, environmental issues, air pollution, climate change, the high cost of both maintaining our transportation infrastructure and for a lot of households to be able to maintain ownership of a vehicle.
Here in the Valley, we experience that whole range of issues. But the 40-year question of how to solve the entrance to Aspen revolves around congestion. So I asked Dutzik how his expertise, policy, can ease delays for commuters.
The way that we have tended in the United States to try to solve congestion is by making our streets wider. I've heard that likened to the idea that the cure for obesity is letting out a couple of notches on your belt.
I have to interrupt because I was looking through your Twitter feed and you posted a photo of, you know, like a Google Live traffic and all the red lines, you know, where it means like we are in stopped traffic. Those were on 10 to 16 lane roads.
Right, exactly. There was a recent experience in Houston where they spent billions of dollars to widen an already wide highway. They made one of the widest highways in the history of the world, and it was congested again a couple of years later. And so I think we've come to realize that widening roads is not really a solution to the congestion problem. Where things can be a solution is new ways to think about pricing roads. Currently, but you don't really pay for the infrastructure that you use. And so the more that, you know, you think about any place where they give things away for free, you know, you think about a Black Friday sale at Walmart. You know, when things are really cheap, people come out of the woodwork and they fight for them. And that's really what we do with our free road space every single day, as we fight for what we perceive to be our share of it. So pricing has been held out as an option. And there's a lot of other smaller interventions, ways that we can help to make traffic move a little smoother, give people more opportunities and more choices to not be stuck in traffic.
Also speaking as part of the Institute's Transportation Forum is Greg Rooks. He works for the Rocky Mountain Institute in Basalt, but I reached him in Austin, Texas, where he's overseeing a living lab sort of experiment, throwing new transportation technology into the wild and analyzing how people take to it. I ask him if any of that Austin stuff is applicable here in Aspen.
One of the things Austin is doing, and actually several cities are doing, are moving more toward high-frequency transit corridors that carry a lot of people, that are major commuting corridors. And the key is connecting people to those high-frequency corridors with what we commonly refer to as first and last mile connections. And we think some of these new on-demand and flexible services can serve that role of getting people from a neighborhood where there isn't a transit stop over to the nearest transit stop to get somebody onto the bus that then moves along that corridor. So that kind of first-last mile connectivity could be really, I believe, applicable in the Roaring Fork Valley because you've already got a high-frequency corridor. So there's an opportunity, I think, to bring a lot more people onto what is already arguably a high-frequency trunk line that's served relatively well by RAFTA
My final question is going to make you pull your hair out. Why would it be good for most of the people commuting up and down 82 to be riding the bus?
Well, anyone who's ever tried to get into Aspen around rush hour can probably attest to the fact that the bus passes them in the dedicated bus lane that's on the right of 82 on the way into Aspen. So that would be the obvious answer, is you'll get there faster. And then what people are doing, of course, in their cars on the way to work is focusing on driving. When you're sitting in a bus, you know, you can read, you can take a nap, the buses have Wi-Fi, you can do productive work. So it's starting to just think about time a little bit differently. And then, of course, the final one is cost. You know, I mentioned personally owned vehicles are very expensive to operate, and people tend to underestimate what their fully burdened cost is. And public transit tends to be a lot cheaper, you know, per mile than driving.
Transportation expert Greg Rux will be speaking on June 6th, Tony Dutzik on May 24th, as part of the Aspen Institute's Community Forum for Transportation and Mobility. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm. Stay in the know with what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and like us on Facebook for up-to-the-minute news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
Full-time staff member of the Roaring Fork School District can now enter into a housing lottery that opened last week.
The rental units are part of the school district's $144 million bond that passed in 2015. $15 million of those dollars were allocated towards apartments in each of the school district's communities. Willits has 17 units, Carbondale has 20, and Glenwood Springs 18. Some will be available in August, others in the summer of 2018. A spokesperson from the district said there are already more applications turned in than available units. Eligible participants have until May 26th to submit their applications.
Applications for this year's Valley Artist Booth at Mountain Fair in Carbondale are being accepted through tomorrow. Claire Woodcock has the details.
When the Carbondale Mountain Fair began back in 1972, 20 booths showcased the works of local artists and artisans. Now in its 46th year, the three-day event draws over 145 vendors, handmade wares, and attracts 20,000 people from all over. The Mountain Fair Locals booth allows artists from the Valley to exhibit and sell their artwork through the nonprofit Carbondale Arts. But space is limited, so applicants must be current members of the nonprofit and also must reside within the Valley. The merchandise must be personally handmade, not manufactured or imported. Criteria for judging includes the quality and uniqueness of the items. The application can be found online at carbondalearts.org, and this year's festival kicks off July 28th. Claire Woodcock, Edless Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
This spring, Karen Kinneman was hired as Pitkin County's first public health director. Allison Bektesh visited Kinneman as she settled into her new office in the Health and Human Services building in Aspen. They spoke about the goals of her new department.
Are there some services you provide that you hear over and over again that people don't know about?
Well, I think emergency preparedness and response, you kind of think about that at the more at the like CDC level in the movies you watch, but don't think about it maybe in context of our local community. Because Pitkin County hasn't really had that integration of environmental health, I think sometimes people don't always think about restaurant inspections as being an environmental health component and really looking at spread of disease within restaurants, looking at things like global warming and the impact to public's health. And then we've been talking a lot about how do we create the social and environmental conditions where people can thrive? And so that can be everything from looking at poverty within community and really thinking about that in relation to people's health, looking at multimodal transportation and built environment. So for me, public health is so all-encompassing.
Do you partner with RAFTA or housing and stuff to say, hey guys, if we can cut down on commute times, we'll have a healthier community?
Sure, so that's a goal. Housing and transportation, social isolation, chronic stress are all things that are social determinants of health, and so definitely wanting to work with those parties and organizations to think about that, exactly that.
Do you have data, like if your community is healthy, bing, bing, bong is also working well. When it's not, these other things are not working well.
I think looking at the relationship between wealth and health is always a really interesting piece. And when you see great wealth disparity, you might see great health disparity. Also, we know that zip code is just as important as your genetic code. And so thinking about the context of where people live and how that all plays out really in the long run.
What are some key things someone who doesn't have a lot of access to health can do to prevent worsening a case of either mental or physical health?
Sure. So I think about public health kind of in three buckets, public health 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. And when we think about public health 1.0, that's the simple things like washing your hands. Public health 2.0 is more around the choices we make around what we eat and the choices we make around exercise. And then 3.0 is kind of, again, creating the conditions where people can thrive and be healthy. So how do we create an environment where the healthy choice is the easy choice?
Karen Kenneman leads Pitkin County's newly formed public health department. For Aspen Public Radio, I'm Allison Bechtesh.
Dr. Brian Hannigan will begin as CEO of Holy Cross Energy in June. Holy Cross is an electric cooperative that serves more than 42,000 customers in western Colorado. Hannigan has led research teams and previously served as an energy advisor to the U.S. Senate and the George W. Bush White House. He spoke with Wyatt about the utility's direction as well as the general direction of energy consumption.
What will electric generation look like in 50 years?
I prefer to think of innovation in the 10 to 20 year time frame. The consumer of tomorrow will likely have some form of generation of electricity on their home. They'll also have a grid connection, of course, for backup and reliability. And they'll be doing things not only to power the outlets and the lights, but they will probably be getting that transportation service that they're looking for from an electric or a hydrogen-fueled vehicle that they can fuel at home. In the middle of it all is a set of sensors and controls that does a lot of this seamlessly for the consumer, so that all you have to think about is living your life. And the question is, how do we build the grid in order to support that new way of doing business?
How do you build the grid in order to support that?
Well, a lot of it is around data and controls, the ability to, in effect, have all of these new devices play like individual instruments in an orchestra and coordinate with one another.
It seems as if a lot of your work has been focused on integrating renewables into the grid. Are renewables reliable?
They can be reliable if done correctly. I think the real question is, what are the ways in which we can bring some of these new technologies into our members so that they have the opportunity to choose them if they want to? And that's really important to me. I mean, a lot of folks are happy with what they're getting from Holy Cross. We first have to be safe. We first have to be reliable. We first have to be affordable. If we do all that, then that gives us the license then to say, all right, how do we make our system more sustainable?
Could Holy Cross be generating its own electricity?
It absolutely could, and it already is. Holy Cross has several utility-scale renewables. We have part ownership share in the Comanche coal facility near Pueblo, and that's a pretty significant part of our power supply at present. So I think increasingly you'll see people who are concerned about the reliability of the grid, who are concerned about the environmental footprint, looking at these local resources and saying, hey, you know, if we can put solar panels on our roof for the same cost, why not do that? It gives us more resilience in case we do lose the grid supply for whatever reason. It gives us more local economic development and job creation if we can do that with installers and servicers that are in our community.
You're about to take the helm of a utility that serves a pretty politically diverse region. Do low energy bills circumvent politics?
Thinking about how we thoughtfully transition to a more sustainable, a lower carbon, a lower environmental footprint mix of resources is going to be an important part of the next 5 to 10 years for Holy Cross. And it's got to be done carefully, because if we move up just 100% to what are today, at least, higher cost sources of renewable electricity, there's going to be an impact on the bills. There's going to be an impact in the way that we operate our facilities. But the costs of wind and solar, the ability to integrate them into the grid seamlessly, all of those things are rapidly improving. And so we would be prudent to keep an eye on that and figure out at what point does it make sense to look to those increasingly as part of our mix. That's one of the beauties of a member cooperative. Everybody from the ranchers and the farmers on the western slope to the folks in the big cities of Aspen and Vail, your members are your owners, and that gives them the right and in some cases the obligation to sit at the table and help us chart our future forward.
Brian Hannigan, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Carolyn Sakariasin. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday afternoon, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
Young and newborn wildlife often attract the attention of well-meaning citizens. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, wildlife agencies and local nonprofits are reminding people to keep their distance.
The Aspen Center for Environmental Studies gets dozens of calls every spring from concerned wildlife lovers who have found what seem to be abandoned baby birds. But often the parents remain nearby, and Eliza Burlingame with ACES says the best course of action is to leave the young animals alone.
At that stage of a bird's life, they really need their parent to be able to succeed, learn how to hunt, learn how to fly.
ACES does have a permit to rehabilitate birds of prey, but Burlingame says there isn't much the nonprofit can do to help most newborn wild animals. The state agency Colorado Parks and Wildlife has some resources to handle injured animals. Officials there also stress the importance of keeping your distance. To protect them from predators, newborn mammals don't have a scent. When humans touch them, it leaves behind a foreign scent that adult animals may not recognize, which can endanger the young. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Tuesday night, Carbondale police told town trustees that crime is flat, and even down in some cases. The data was culled from the past 7 years.
Gene Schilling is Carbondale's police chief. He acknowledges that the town has seen a, quote, spat of serious crime, end quote, over the past few years. There was a homicide, and several armed robberies. But the numbers suggest the town is seeing consistent crime levels, and less in some cases. Since 2014, fewer people have been calling the police. Between 2015 and 2016, reported thefts cut in half. Numbers can be misleading, and they don't tell the whole story. Schilling says he has reason to believe heroin and methamphetamine use is up in the town, but that's not necessarily reflected in the numbers compiled for the trustees. The trustees asked the police department to conduct the study following a sexual assault in 2016.
Earlier this month, Claire Woodcock was in Breckenridge for the annual Colorado Creative Industries Summit. She spoke with producer Kristen Kay about the mission of this organization.
Hi, Claire.
Hey, Kristen, how's it going?
Great. So let's start with, what is Colorado Creative Industries?
Colorado Creative Industries, or CCI for short, is the designated state's arts agency housed in Governor John Hickenlooper's Office of Economic Development and International Trade in Denver. And this program strives to support and expand the impact of creative industries, artists, and entrepreneurs while advancing and driving Colorado's economy.
Is Colorado Creative Industries involved with anything locally?
So in the last 7 years, CCI has developed a bunch of programs to help boost arts and the economy in the state. One of them is the Space to Create program, which is a state-driven initiative for affordable housing for artists and creative sector workers, and it's the first program like this in the nation. Space to Create facilitates the development of 9 projects in 8 regions in Colorado's rural, small towns, and mountain communities. This year, Carbondale is up against Paonia and Crested Butte for this region's selection. I spoke with Amy Kimberly, executive director of Carbondale Arts, back in March for a story I did on the Space to Create program.
And what did she say?
She said that affordable space is really scarce in Carbondale and that the town faces losing the creatives that have grown up or moved here to make art.
We need development and we want smart development. And project like this is the kind of development that will provide opportunity in our community.
CCI developed other programs too, like the state's public arts program, Poetry Out Loud for high school students, Creative Capital's rotating arts exhibition, Colorado Music. It also provides arts education resources in the form of grants.
So what was the coolest thing you took away from the summit?
I went to this seminar called Play It Again, How a History Museum Can Support Colorado's Musicians and Music Industry. And I found out that History Colorado, the state's museum located in Denver, is working on this long-term project on the history of Colorado music, from the folk revival to the rock and roll youth counterculture to the state's festival scene. And that exhibit opens in March 2019.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for my award-winning show, Valley Roundup. I talk with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.